a.m. at 1904 East Main Street in Urbana. Online at quaker.org/urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today is Ralph Martire. We're talking with him by phone. Ralph, can you hear me all right?
Yes, fine. How are you today?
Ralph is the executive director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, and boy, have you had a busy week.
Well, it's a good week, I guess, if there is such a thing as a good week for someone who does a lot of tax policy in their day-to-day life.
Right. Well, with Governor Quinn's budget out and changes suggested for the tax structure, I'm sure many people have been calling you, and we certainly feel fortunate that you agreed to speak with us for a whole hour over a month ago, and it happened to be at a time when we certainly have a lot to talk about. So let's just jump right in. Tell us a little bit about the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. I know it's been around just since 1990.
Well, actually, since the year 2000.
2000.
So you're
giving
us 10 years of duration we haven't had.
2000. Okay, sorry.
We are a nonprofit. We're a think tank, and we're bipartisan, and that makes us uniquely non-ideological in our approach to these public policy things. What we try to do is look at the data, the hard, cold facts, if you will, and take sound economic principles or best practices from a public service standpoint, be it education, healthcare, whatever, put the two together and say, look, it shouldn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican, this is the right way to go for these reasons and these facts, and try to take a lot of that partisan rhetoric out of this process and focus more on how you can move forward.
And you have a relatively small staff.
That's true. We have about six folks, but we've had a decent impact. We've only been around since the year 2000, but we've had a hand in getting about $2 billion worth of legislation passed in the state of Illinois, which is pretty good. Everything from the state's earned income tax credit, which I drafted the legislation for then State Senator Barack Obama, who has gone on to other things. Frankly, he's not as useful to us now. He's got this other job that just has taken him out of the sphere of influence we care about. And we also did things like corporate accountability legislation. So if a business gets a tax break to, let's say, create a certain number of jobs, et cetera, they actually have to create those jobs, and they have to report it publicly. And if they're not doing what they've promised to do in exchange for this tax break, the state can cut it off or even claw it back. So we've done a wide range of things here in the state of Illinois, and hopefully for the betterment of Illinois itself.
Now, CTBA does focus just on the state of Illinois, but since we have many listeners in Indiana, some of the things we're going to be talking about during this program are certainly relevant there.
Well, yeah, actually, and we don't focus just on the state of Illinois. In fact, we just were retained to do a little work in the states of Indiana, Kansas, and Ohio. So for the state of Indiana, we're going to be preparing, a taxpayer-friendly or a normal person, I should say, friendly budget analysis, sort of a citizen's guide to the budget, which shows how the state of Indiana both raises and spends its money in very simple language so that voters and taxpayers in that great state have an opportunity to really understand what's going on some of these complex fiscal matters.
Now, you're funded mainly by a wide assortment of groups, but not primarily by individuals, right?
That's correct, although any individual out there that wants to write us a check, we are tax-deductible as a 501c3, but we get most of our money from two primary sources, really from the foundation community and then from public employee unions and businesses. Those are the three biggest sort of contributors to our organization.
I noticed the Joyce Foundation is one of your contributors, Alphawood Foundation, Grand Victoria, Woods Fund of Chicago.
Right. In fact, the Woods Fund of Chicago actually thought of the organization. They put it together. They merely hired me to be the first ever executive director.
So you've been there since 2000?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And you also have a policy task force, and I noticed of the 13 folks on that, I think five are from here at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana.
Yeah, we do a lot of work with the good folks at Champaign-Urbana. It's a wonderful university, as you well know, and they certainly are high-quality folks. Two in particular, I mean, Jim Nolan, who's our research director and is on the Institute for Government and Public Affairs, and Fred Gertz, who's just a wonderful guy and a brilliant economist, and has helped us a lot.
And the Lubienskis, yes.
Yes, and the Lubienskis. On the school funding side, they've done some of the best and I think most groundbreaking work in the nation on being able to take the impact of demographics, that is income class, racial class, and racial identity, I should say, and taken those factors and been able to account for them in test scores, and so you can have a more honest comparison between public schools and private schools, and I think really, really wonderful work.
Ralph, before we get into the content of the show, let me just mention that we're fortunate to have here in the studio with me an intern, Carly Nix, a recent graduate in the field of religion from Boston University, and she's here in the studio. So Carly will be asking questions too, making comments, and in later shows she'll be taking over completely a time or two. So we're looking forward to that.
Hello. Well,
feel free to ask away, Carly. See if I can keep up with you.
I'll do my best.
And I should say in introducing you that you're a graduate from Indiana University, Phi Beta Kappa in history. You're law degree is from University of Michigan, and we're delighted to have you on the show today.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
Let me give the phone numbers for people who want to call in and ask direct questions. We encourage our listeners to join the conversation. Those in Champaign-Urbana, where the program originates, may punch in 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're listening long distance, including on the internet, you may punch in 1-800-222-9455. So we're eager to have people join the conversation. Let's begin, if we could, Ralph. Illinois, to start with Illinois, I heard you say at a presentation you made to Protestants for the Common Good Board that Illinois is the fifth largest state in terms of total economy, with $600 billion, I think you said, annually.
That's right. We have an economy that's just north of $600 billion. That would make us the fifth largest state economically of any state, and in fact, we had the fifth largest population as well. If you wanted to compare us to the rest of the world, if Illinois were an independent country, we'd actually be the 27th richest country in the world. So we have a pretty large economy overall. We have a bigger economy than, let's say, Ireland, Saudi Arabia, Norway, Greece, places most of your listeners have probably heard of.
Now, as we might have expected, the Chicago Tribune, in response to Pat Quinn's budget, has talked about doubling of the income tax here in the state and decrying the increased taxes. How much of a tax burden does Illinois really have compared to other states?
Well, you know, we really are one of the lowest taxing states in the nation, and for an honest comparison, you really have to look at tax burden as a percentage of income, and why would that be an honest comparison? I mean, certainly in a big state like Illinois, we have a lot more people than most other states and a lot bigger economy than most other states. We raise more in tax revenue than, let's say, Maine or Rhode Island, right? Those states have, what, three or four people. So really comparing us to them, that's a little silly just on total tax dollars raised. But if you look at tax burden as a percentage of income, you can get a pretty good handle on this stuff, because no matter what your income level, if the state's taking 15 or 16% of your income, you've got a pretty good handle on what your tax burden is going to be. As a percentage of income, despite having the fifth largest population and economy of any state in the country, Illinois ranks 45th in tax burden. We are very low tax overall. Well, you know, one of the kickers is we might be very low tax overall, but we are high tax for most people, for low and middle income families, because in addition to being sort of low tax and having a poor revenue mix to begin with, we're very regressive. We are very unfair in how we tax. So we impose a much greater burden on low and middle income families than we do on affluent families. And so that's how we can be low tax overall. We undertax really wealthy people, and high tax for low- and middle-income families all at the same time. It's about as poorly designed a fiscal system as you could have. I mean, if someone set out to create the model bad tax system, they'd come up with something a lot like what Illinois has.
Do you find it hard to defend your designation of bipartisan with views like that?
No. I mean, you know, the great thing is it's fact-based. So it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican, you could have your own opinion about what it means to be low tax or high tax, but you can't have your own facts. And the facts are the facts. And we're 45th in tax burden. We're very low tax overall. And we don't tax affluent people enough. And I think maybe one of the things you're getting at there, Carly, is, wait a minute. Republicans are all about reducing taxes, et cetera, et cetera. And that certainly is where the neo-Republican movement has gone, the neocons. But true capitalists, people that actually understand capitalist economic theory, capitalist tax policy, and by the way, my organization, the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, does believe in capitalism. If you believe in it, guess what? None other than Adam Smith, the father of capitalism, the guy that in fact invented the system in the 1750s when he wrote the Wealth of Nations, said that basically if you want fair and responsive taxation in a capitalist economy, what you'll need is progressive taxation, and that is taxes that are higher from a burden standpoint when measured as a percentage of income for affluent individuals and lower middle income families. In fact, you know, the real language in Adam Smith was a lot harsher than what I just said. The father of capitalism said, if you're going to design taxes to be fair and responsive in a capitalist economy, you should design them as much as possible to burden the wealthy and unburden the poor. Now, I'm sure you'd be called a class warrior if you use such charged rhetoric today. But people sort of forget that that's a fundamental aspect of capitalism, and it's one that we have very much forgotten. And certainly Illinois doesn't follow.
But what about fees? You've talked about taxes and where Illinois stacks up in terms of the rest of the states in terms of taxes. What about the fees?
We actually include fees in taxes. We include everything any unit of state or local government charges us, and whether it's called a tax or a fee.
So that's the 45th out of 50 states is the total tax burden, including fees.
Yep.
Wow.
All state and local.
Well, when you go out and give talks like you gave to the group where I was a part of it, the Protestants for the Common Good, and you come in and you say, okay, I'm from this nonprofit, non-aligned Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, and I want to talk about, say, education in Illinois and how underfunded and how inequitable it is in terms of its funding. And when you get invited to places where people are very much concerned about their property taxes. How do you make the case?
Well, people are concerned about their property taxes. I mean, we're low tax overall, but our distribution of taxes is goofy. And goofy is the fiscal term, actually, for Illinois system. So we way over-rely on the property taxes. And we fundamentally over-rely on this property tax component to put the money into school. Well, that sort of triple ringer of bad tax policy. From a fiscal standpoint, if you over-rely on any local source to fund any public service, in this case schools, but any public service, you create sort of a very distortive fiscal policy because it's a local revenue source, so the rates will vary tremendously from one community to another based on how wealthy they are. So if you have a lot of property wealth in your community, you have a low tax rate on your property taxes. If you have not a lot of property wealth or just a middling amount, then you have much higher rates. And so that's distortive of economic behavior. It literally drives businesses out of low and middle income areas, and it makes it very hard for low and middle income areas to attract businesses back in. The second problem, I told you we're a regressive system. Well, if you over-rely on property taxes are a highly regressive tax. They take far more of the income of a lower middle-income family than they do an affluent family. And, you know, the data here are just compelling. Since 1990, but actually the period from 1990 to 2005, property tax revenue grew in the state of Illinois by over 42%. That's after you take out the impact of inflation. So in real terms, the actual growth in property tax revenue over that period of time, 1990 to 2005, was 42%. Median income, by the way, only went up by 2.8% over that same period. So you have a tax rate or tax burden growing at almost 20 times the growth in income. That's going to hurt most families except for the richest of rich. So now that's your second problem. It's a major contributor to the regressive nature of our tax system. The kicker, this tax burden, this local tax burden, is very hard for low- and middle-income families to bear. It creates much higher tax burden for low- and middle-income families. And in exchange for this higher tax burden, they get the least amount of funding for their education. So the lowest quality public services, the lowest quality education is the return the people that have the highest tax burden get. That is about as absurd as unfair. And I'm not going to use the word immoral, but one of you two certainly could.
It certainly sounds that way.
As immoral a situation as you could have.
When CTBA looks at these kind of issues, do you stop there or do you actually lobby? Do you actually try to educate the taxpayers, the voters, the legislators? Where do you go with this?
Well, you know, most think tanks just sort of stop with the study, and that's stopping a little too soon. I mean, if you just stop and you create a great white paper or a nice research product, you know, that's all well and good, but it becomes a doorstop, really, at the end of the day, and it doesn't change life for people on the street. And if you really care about these things that you find, these big economic or education or tax policy, whatever they are, when you discover them and the facts are so clear and compelling, I think it then becomes incumbent upon your organization to do as much as you can to change public policy, and we really do try to do that. Now, we don't lobby. We do very little lobbying, I should say. We are a 501c3, and as a 501c3, you're allowed to lobby a little bit. You make the election, you could devote up to 20% of your resources to lobbying. We don't get anywhere near that line because frequently, if not on every public policy matter we work on, it's almost everyone. We get appointed as a technical advisor to legislators to work on the issue.
Who appoints you?
The legislature.
Okay.
So we've been appointed by Reverend Senator Meeks to work as his technical advisor on school funding policy and tax policy. Senator Don Harmon, who's the chair of the Senate Revenue Committee, as technical advisor on state revenue issues. Representative John Bradley, a very conservative downstate Democrat, to work on his capital bill. So whenever you get appointed as a technical advisor, you are allowed, of course, to help draft the legislation, to testify, to answer legislators' questions, to say sort of what is sound and what is not sound in any policy initiative. So it really frees you up to get engaged in the policy discussion and hopefully shape the legislation in a way where it'll be the most effective, accomplish the most public good, and really be the most responsible to taxpayers. So we do that a lot. We do a lot of town hall meetings, a lot of media work. I don't know if you know this, but we don't mind going out into the media, be that broadcast or print. I actually write a regular column for the Springfield newspaper, the State Journal Register, which is carried by four or five other newspapers across the state, including Rockford, Joliet, a couple of other communities. And the Sun-Times, I was a regular columnist with them for 5 or 6 years, and they still periodically run my stuff, although I no longer do a regular column for them. They've moved in a direction where they're a little more interested in the flash and the personalities, and it really wouldn't help me to write a column making fun of an elected official's personality if I wanted to change public policy at the end of the day. So that was an uncomfortable situation, and so I had to be able to stay where I could write policy. But the bottom line is we very much try to get out to communities. We try to give information out. When you heard me speak for convening for Protestants for the Common Good.
Right.
I mean, that's the kind of thing we do. We certainly have no problem going to any community anywhere in the state and having a thoughtful discussion and answering questions on these big issues.
Intern Carly Nix and myself, Steve Shoemaker, are talking today with Ralph Martiri, who is the director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, whose online presence can be found at ctbaonline.org, ctbaonline.org. And we welcome listeners to join our conversation, 333-9455, if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area. Perhaps you're listening to this program online at will.illinois.edu. If so, or if it's a long-distance call for you, wherever you might be, 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free call. So we're eager to have people join the conversation about budgets and taxes in Illinois and elsewhere. Well, Patrick Quinn gave his budget this week. What do you think of it?
Well, you know, the first comment I have to make, and I mean this very sincerely, is it's a relief to have a governor who's willing to tell voters and taxpayers what they need to hear rather than just what they want to hear. I mean, for decades, we've had governors and general assemblies that have basically told voters, you can have public services, but you do not have to pay for them. I can't imagine a more dishonest and misleading and irresponsible message to consistently be put before the voting public. But certainly we've had it. And worst of all was probably our most recent governor before Quinn, Mr. Blagojevich, who continually sort of railed on the tax issue while promising to expand program, which, you know, amazing that people would buy that, but certainly it's a message that I guess you'd rather hear than one that involves some personal responsibility. But from the moment Blagojevich took office, the state, he inherited, but the state had deficit after deficit after deficit, multi-billion dollar level, and obviously we're still seeing that now under Governor Quinn, and voters knew this. The media covered this. And still they believed we didn't have to go anywhere near the tax system if we wanted to solve these problems. And I guess one of the tired old saws that comes out of that, well, there's a number of tired old saws. I mean, let's do more with less. I love that piece of rhetoric. I don't know of a business in the country that produces more of anything with less capital and workers, do you? I mean, it's just it's the goofiest thing, but yet that got repeated a lot. But the other sort of tired old saws, you know, I'll fix our problems by just changing our priorities. I'll move money around and put money where it's supposed to be, or I'll be more efficient, or I'll cut spending. Well, let's take each of those in reverse order. Cut spending. Really? You're gonna? Fifth biggest population in the nation, we rank 42nd in spending as a percentage of income. What you gonna cut? What you gonna cut? We are one of the lowest-ranking states in the nation, 49th out of the 50, in the portion of education funding we cover today. We are, you name the human service, we rank at the bottom in the country in funding, in some cases below 50th, because we've fallen below D.C. and Puerto Rico and places like that, and things like funding, let's say, services for developmentally disabled adults, mental health, oh my, we're just off the charts.
It's a tragedy.
It's a tragedy. That's the right word. I wouldn't have come up with that. It's a good word, Steve, and it's the right one. It's a tragedy. So, really, that's what you're going to cut? And I'm picking on things like health care and human services and education, because what all these politicians that have been throwing this rhetoric around don't want you to know is our state already has very good priorities. If you look at how we spend our money, every year, pretty much about 85% of our budget goes to three things. Education's number one, healthcare's number two, and human services are number three. That's 85% of the budget. So if you're going to cut, and we only have about a $28 billion budget for public services, if you're going to cut your spending to balance your budget, and we've got anywhere from a $4 billion to a $9 or $10 billion hole, those are the numbers being bandied about, right, out of $28 billion. So you're already talking anywhere from, 16 to 40% of the budget. You've got to cut education, health, and human services. That's where all the money is. That's 85% of our expenditures. Heck, you throw in public safety, you get up to 90% of our expenditures. Throw in payments on the unfunded pension liability that we're making, we're getting to 94, 95% of our expenditures. I mean, the rhetoric is we'll be more efficient, we'll rearrange priorities, and that rhetoric absolutely doesn't square with any of the data. And anyone who says they can solve our problems by cutting, whether they're an elected official, whether they're a newspaper, the first question you ought to ask them is, what are you going to cut? Put those billions of dollars of cuts on the table. Let voters see, let voters know what health care programs you're going to put under the knife, what human service programs you're going to eviscerate, and what you're going to stop funding in education.
But, Ralph, both Democratic and Republican governors and other state officials have gotten elected by promising no tax raises. And we have a history, at least here in Illinois, I don't know about Indiana, but at least here in Illinois, of governors who did raise taxes don't get reelected. So how can you know this? And I agree, you're right, but how can you know this and still survive politically?
Well, you know, it's the case sometimes, but not all the times. I mean, let the classic examples used are Ogilvie, when Ogilvie gave us the income tax after the Constitutional Convention in 1970, and then lost to Dan Walker. Well, Dan Walker, charismatic and charming and criminal, everything we seem to like in a governor. So, of course, he was able to beat Ogilvie, who couldn't smile because of a nerve injury in his face from the war. I don't know if you knew that.
No.
But he literally could not smile. He wasn't stoic because he grew up on some Gothic farm. He was stoic due to an injury. Of course Walker won that election. But every state rep and every state senator that voted to bring that income tax increase to Illinois who ran for reelection got reelected. And you could bet every one of their opponents ran an anti-tax campaign against them. Now, more recently, everyone picks on the Dawn Clark Netsch campaign when Dawn ran against Governor Edgar. And true, he beat her with the tax increase issue like a blunt instrument, okay? He absolutely did. But remember, that was 1994. It was the year of the Republican landslide. It's when popular Democratic governors who were incumbent in states like New York, Mario Cuomo, lost to the relatively unknown Pataki. In Texas, you had Ann Richards, a very popular Democratic governor, went down in the Republican landslide to some George W. character or another. And of course, in Illinois, you have a liberal Democrat running to unseat a popular incumbent moderate Republican. It just wasn't going to happen. But what people forget, Edgar, the first time he ran for governor, when he was not the incumbent, and it was an open seat, and he was running against Democrat Neil Hardigan, Edgar was the tax candidate. Remember, under Jim Thompson, we had just increased our state's income tax from 2.5% to 3%. Edgar said, I'm going to keep it at 3% permanently because the state just simply can't afford to lose the revenue. We wouldn't be able to balance our books. Neil Hardigan said, no, 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 we don't need that money. I'm going to give you your money back. He's a tax and spender. I am not. Edgar won. So it's not as cut and dried as it would seem. Now, fast forward to today, we have the worst fiscal crisis in the history of our state that just so happens to be occurring during the worst recession since the Great Depression, okay? And, in fact, a very long-lasting recession. And so the question that's in front of the Quinn's administration is how do you deal with this massive deficit, anywhere from $4.5 to $9 billion, in light of a recession? And the answer, very clearly, by the way, is the best thing you can do for your state's economy, the best way to shorten the recession, is to raise taxes progressively and maintain or increase public spending. Reasons for that are pretty simple. If you really do have a big recession, and we really do have a big recession. And, you know, it's already lasted 15 months, and the average length of every recession since the 1930s has just been 10 months. So we're already almost 50% longer than your average recession, and there's no end in sight. So it's a big, deep recession we're in.
I was hoping you'd tell us when it was going to end.
Well, all estimates are, and I sort of agree with this, late 2010, August, September, 2010 is really when we'll start turning around. I mean, we'll bottom out sometime before then, but not really much. And the reason for my view on that is that we have about 1 million units of excess housing stock still on the market, and the demand for housing stock is about 500,000 units a year. So if you figure it'll take 2 years to suck up the excess stock that we already have, housing starts won't really begin to happen for, you know, a couple of years. And
but I apologize for interrupting. You were in the middle of saying why you thought Quinn's response was appropriate.
Well, yeah, it's because of this, actually. We're actually talking about good stuff. Since the recession is going to be long and deep, if the state government were to cut its spending, that's dollar for dollar out of your economy. In fact, it's worse than that. So as your economy is contracting, you're going to make it contract further because state government's not spending. And what state government spends on, public services, you need to understand, are salaries primarily. About 80-85% of state government expenditures go to pay the salaries of individuals who provide those public services. So you're cutting spending on people's salaries, which then has them stop spending in the economy. So you get a negative multiplier. In fact, for general public services, a negative multiplier for every dollar the state cuts in spending, you lose $1.36 of economic activity. So if our budget deficit were as big as $9 billion, say, we would lose 128,000 jobs in the Illinois economy in the next year if the state balanced its budget totally by cutting spending. I don't think anyone would argue that state action that causes us to lose 128,000 jobs would be a good thing right now.
That's unimaginable.
Unimaginable. Right. Now, raising taxes progressively, on the other hand, doesn't take a dollar for dollar out of your economy, but the spending puts more than a dollar in, like I said, the multiplier effect. And why it doesn't take dollar for dollar out of your economy, if it's a progressive tax increase, that means it focuses more on affluent individuals. Now, affluent individuals don't spend most of their money. In fact, they save most of their money. They make so much money that their consumption patterns are a very small portion of their personal income for a year. So if you tax them more, they're not going to cut their spending per se. They're going to cut their savings. And then even if they did cut back some of their spending, it's probably not going to be their local spending. They're still going to have their lawn service take care of the lawn. They're still going to have the cooks and the home cleaners and all those other sort of local expenditures they make. What they might do is take one less trip abroad or buy one less luxury item that's not manufactured or sold here in Illinois. So the net is you don't take a dollar for dollar out of your economy when you have a progressive tax during a recession, and you get more than a dollar for a dollar's worth of spending. It's really, and this isn't just me talking, by the way. I mean, Steve, your listeners ought to know this is Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, certainly a notable guy. He won a Nobel Prize. He's pretty smart. And even very conservative economists. We use the When we did this analysis, we used the multipliers designed by a guy named Mark Zandi. He's the chief economist for Moody's.com, and his most recent political activity was he was the main economic advisor to John McCain in McCain's presidential run. So he's a pretty conservative economist, and we used his approach to looking at these things. So the bottom line is, and if your listeners would want to know more, they could go to our website. We actually have a report on this called Moving Forward. And it really lays out in detail the methodology and how you can come up with this. But the bottom line is...
And the website is, again, ctbaonline.org.
But the bottom line is pretty clear. I mean, Quinn is certainly on the right path. Now, where we disagreed with Governor Quinn, and they're mild disagreements. It's great to have a governor in place who's an adult and who's willing to deal with this issue and willing to be honest with voters. I think you really can't say that enough. And so I'm probably going to repeat it 20 times. But the bottom line is we don't think the 1.5% is enough, quite frankly. You think we have to go up to 2%. And we also believe that you have to expand the state sales tax base to include some consumer services or you're really not going to end up getting the full job done. Now, our state sales tax pretty much only applies to the sale of goods, products, hard physical things you can literally touch, like a book or a necktie or a baseball or a compact disc or a DVD, those kinds of things.
Whereas the service economy has really been growing.
Yeah, I mean, not only has it really been growing, it's by far and away the largest portion of the Illinois economy. It's over 60% of our Illinois economy today, whereas the sale of products and hard physical goods is just 12%. And so we leave the products and hard physical goods out of our economy, in our tax base, and we leave out the biggest and fastest-growing segment of our tax base. That won't work. It's not possible for it to work, and we really need to expand the sales tax base to include at least consumer services. Now, someone out there, one of the people listening to your program is going to say, wait a minute, won't that hurt our economy? Won't that hurt us? Won't that make us uncompetitive? And my short answer is, let me think about it, no. And the reason not is, again, very clear. Today, already, from Illinois' standpoint anyway, all of our neighboring states, including Indiana, by the way, already tax services far more than we do. Indiana, Kentucky, and Missouri tax 30 to 60%, depending on the state, of the services we feel Illinois needs to tax to be competitive and to be able to balance its budget. Iowa and Wisconsin already tax all of them. So, I mean, it's an interesting thing if you really put all this stuff in context. Illinois has the fifth largest economy, fifth largest population. 45th in tax burden. Lower tax burden than virtually all of our neighboring states except Missouri, and Missouri is 0.1% lower in taxes than us. So virtual tie with Missouri. Yet despite all these natural advantages, low taxes, high economy, big population, our economic growth in Illinois has lagged the Midwest and the nation for 20 years. So clearly our low taxes haven't bought us economic competitiveness. In fact, just the opposite, we've fallen apart. And all of our neighboring states, which understand that they have to balance their budget, that they have to make investments in needed things like infrastructure and education, have done a better job growing their economy. So this will just make Illinois tax more like its neighbors, but it won't hurt it competitively at all. In fact, it will help grow its economy.
Ralph Martiri, the Executive Director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability in Chicago, is our guest today here talking about taxes and budgets, particularly in Illinois, but also Indiana. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana, a broadcasting service of the College of Media here at Illinois. I'm Steve Shoemaker, along with Carly Nix, our intern for this program, who's also helping out on the television side here at WILL. Happy to have her in the studio with us today as we talk by phone with our guest. We're about halfway through the program, a little past. Let me take just a moment to make a few announcements. Coming up here on Keeping the Faith in the weeks ahead, we have some interesting guests and topics. We'll be talking about World Hunger, April 5th, with people from the Crop Walk, Esther Portnoy and others, professor, emeritus professor here at the University of Illinois. We'll be talking about green cemeteries, particularly in Illinois, with Jane Zawakowski on April 12th, April 19th. Our guest will be a Christian theologian, Donald McKim, who will be a guest here at, in Champaign-Urbana, giving some talks. Al Sharp, who's the executive director of Protestants for the Common Good, and I believe is Al still vice president of CTBA, your board?
He sure is, and a valuable board member at that.
Great. He'll be a guest here via phone April 26th. So those are some of the people coming up on Keeping the Faith in the weeks ahead. Let me remind listeners, you can call in with comments or questions at any time. We are live here at WILL 333-9455 locally. 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free number. Let me mention that support for this program is provided, as you heard, by the Quaker Meeting House in Urbana and also by the University YMCA. At the Y coming up this week, since spring break is happening here, there are no programs for the public, but Know Your University will start up again March 31st at Tuesday noon with the 4th Annual Champaign-Urbana Edible Books Festival. And if you're interested in entering something in that, learning more about it, go to library.illinois.edu/ediblebooks. The Edible Books Festival is an international event held close to April 1st, and the University Library is sponsoring that here at the University Y again. And that Friday Forum, will start up again, talking about the promise and perils of new technology. And April 3rd, the guest will be Professor Bruce Folk from the Department of Microbiology and Geology, an interesting combination. He'll be talking about the microbial life in Yellowstone Park, a catalyst for environmental change. That's April 3rd at the University of YMCA in Champaign, 1001 South Wright Street. It's a lunchtime lecture. You can get lunch there at the Y. Do call in and make a reservation if you can, 337-1500, anytime between now and the next lecture. We have another program I'd like to mention coming up April 18. That's a Saturday at Wesley Foundation, Wesley United Methodist Church here in Urbana. There'll be a film called For the Bible Tells Me So that talks about five different families and how they responded positively to learning that a family member was gay or lesbian. That's coming up Saturday at 1 p.m. at Wesley Foundation, April 18. That's a free program, and listeners are encouraged to participate. Well, we have several callers waiting to talk with our guest, Ralph Bertieri. Carly Nix and I are in the studio. Let's go first to line number four, our toll-free line. Yes, you're on the air. Line number four?
Hello, yes. Hi.
Go right ahead.
Thank you for taking the call. My question was on the recent discussion from the guest. He talked about how a progressive tax would be beneficial and then went on to talk about that expanding the sales tax would also be beneficial. And my understanding is that the sales tax would be a regressive tax. So I wonder if you could talk about reconciling those two views. Thanks.
And actually, it's a great point. And sales tax is regressive tax. And so when we talk about a tax reform, there's two different ways to look at the fiscal system. The first thing is you have to design it to work, to generate enough revenue on a stable, efficient, and responsive basis. Those are three of the four principles you need: stable, efficient, and responsive. You want it to generate revenue on that basis over the long term, and that's what expanding the sales tax base does for us. But once you've got it designed the right way from those three principles standpoint, you need to then layer in the fourth principle of fairness. And to make a tax system fair that has to rely on a broad-based service tax, and ours does, what you need to do is relieve that service tax liability on low- and middle-income families through a refundable tax credit, much like the earned income tax credit that works at the federal level. And here's why that relieves the tax burden that's paid outside of the income tax playing field. Say you qualify as a low-income family for a $500 tax credit, refundable tax credit. The word refundable is key. But you only owe the state of Illinois, let's say, or Indiana, $300 in income taxes. Well, you got a $500 credit. You only owe $300 in income taxes, so you don't have to pay that $300 in income taxes. The credit eats it all up, leaving a balance of $200. Now, if the credit is refundable, you, the taxpayer, get a check for that $200 balance. You get the full value of your tax credit, even if it's greater than what you owe in income tax liability. The reason you design taxes to have a refundable credit in this area is because for most low- and middle-income families, income tax isn't the sweet spot of what creates tax burden for them. It's the things like the sales tax, the excise taxes, the property taxes, the payroll taxes. So to get at those other taxes, you design relief that's greater than the income tax liability, and then it starts cutting into the other taxes they pay. And in the legislation we helped put into the state of Illinois that would expand the state sales tax base to include consumer services and would increase the state's income tax rate from 3% to 5%, we also included a very large refundable tax credit that went all the way up to taxpayers earning $56,000 a year or less. So, and it relieved the impact of expanding the sales tax base as well as the impact of the income tax increase on literally 60% of the taxpayers in the state. So it's a great question, but it's certainly part of how you design a fiscal system to work. You look at all the ways the revenue side has to work for it to be something that will let your state be solvent and maintain or enhance public services over time, but then you want to make sure that the final incidence of tax burden is fair, and you design these targeted tax relief items like a refundable credit to really reach the people you want to reach.
Thank you for that question. I want to go to line number one, but before we have that person ask a question, let me just follow up just very quickly. In Governor Quinn's suggested proposed budget, he has tax credit increase, significant increase, but was that refundable?
No. I mean, here's one of our other differences of opinion with the governor's general approach right now. Certainly increasing the dependent exemption and the personal exemption helps low- and middle-income families. They won't, depending on how many dependents they have, which is a weird way to say it, depending on how many dependents. But anyway, depending on that, they won't have to pay much of the income tax increase, if at all. Let's say a family of four earning, I think, right around the number that I talked about, $55,000, $56,000 a year under Governor Quinn's approach, wouldn't pay more in taxes because the dependent exemption increase that he's pushing would wipe out the income tax increase on them. They'd be in the same position as they were before his tax increase.
From $2,000 up to $6,000 per person, yeah.
Right. Okay. The problem with that is it only gets to income tax liability.
Right.
So it doesn't get to the other taxes that they really pay, number one. It's not refundable, number two. Number three, it's not very targeted because everyone gets to share in it. So literally millionaires would get the tax relief offered by this dependent exemption as well.
Sure.
We would like a more targeted approach to tax relief that really focused the relief just where you wanted it to go while allowing you to tax where you want to tax.
Okay, we have a very patient listener with a question or comment on line one. Yes, go ahead, please.
Well, it's been worth listening to. This guest is terrific.
Isn't he great?
Yes, he is. It goes to my question. It seems to me that most of the media spends its time reporting on the squabbles between the political parties with respect to this. I'll say that the Democrats are in favor of a capital bill, but the Republicans are against raising taxes. What efforts does your group do to educate the media and reporting on these economic issues? Because other than WILL, it seems like we're in a desert of reporting.
Well, I would agree with you on that. And, we do our best. We're a small organization. I mean, certainly if we had more resources, we would do much more sustained and regular media briefings. As it is, we try to get in with as many major media outlets as we can to provide them good information. Because I think what you said at the beginning of your comment is spot on accurate. Most newspapers, most broadcast media, most internet media focus on the rhetoric. They focus on the partisan jousting, the politics. That's what people think in the media industry sells. So, they've really made a decision that the voting public doesn't really care much about the substance of these big issues. They'd really rather hear the ideological fights and the little barbs and the personality nonsense that goes on back and forth. Now, I happen to disagree with that. I think most voters really want to understand whether or not a proposal is something they should support from a substantive standpoint. I really think most people are substantive, but that's really not the media's mindset. So we try to educate them. We do ed board meetings. In fact, I have four coming up in the next 3 weeks. We really try to get it out, but even if you meet with them, even if you try to give them good information, even if you answer all their questions, they still may not come around because I've literally had this said to me, well, this is a little too complex for our typical consumer. So we're not even going to go there, even though we might think you're right here. We're just going to keep saying what we've been saying. I've literally had that said to me in an ed board meeting.
Well, I'd accept WILL from that.
We are exempting present company.
Okay, thank you.
Very kind. Thanks for the question. You do try to make it clear, though, when you make your presentations. You have graphs, you have charts, you have comparisons that and you try to make it entertaining. I was impressed that I'm not a budget wonk, but I thought you had my interest the whole hour.
You are a great American.
We'll see if that's true. Line number two, we have another comment or question, please.
Hi.
Yes.
I think this may make me very unpopular with my fellow retirees, but I have a suggestion. I wonder what you think about it and whether the constitutionality of it. A retirement income is free of Illinois taxation. Of course, it's taxed as federal income to the extent that it's not been previously taxed. I was wondering if there's any way, perhaps, that the state might institute a tax at least on the higher pensions.
Well, it would make great sense for them to do it, but the politics of that one make it almost impossible. And once again, you have a very good comment to make. Of the 41 states in the nation that assess an income tax, 9 don't, but 41 do. All but 3 of them tax retirement income. We are one of the 3 that does not. Us, Pennsylvania, and I forget the third. It might be Florida. But, it's very interesting that every other state does it. and the federal government does it, but Illinois doesn't. And as the baby boomer generation gets to retirement age, and that's exactly where we are right now, there's a lot more economic activity in retirement income. And if we were just to say, one initial proposal my organization got a legislator to put in a few years ago, maybe 5 years ago now, in Illinois, would have taxed pension income only if the retirement income earned by the retiree exceeded $75,000 a year. We excluded Social Security income from that, so it would have to be private retirement income over and above Social Security that came in at $75,000 a year, and only the amount over $75,000 a year, and it was dead on arrival.
Where did it get stopped and why?
It never made it out of committee, and everyone, you know, people just basically said, look, you can't go after pension income. Retirees are hurting, and there was no opportunity to get it past the visceral and emotional. People wouldn't listen to facts, and senior citizens vote, and legislators are very afraid of them. And put all those factors together, it's a political issue that I don't think very many politicians would ever be willing to tackle.
Ralph Materi, the director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, can be found online, ctbaonline.org. You can find out more about the organization, more about its policies, its programs, its efforts. Ralph, what would you suggest to listeners, like our last caller, who think beyond personal selfish interests and really are concerned with the well-being of the state as a whole, the nation as a whole?
You mean besides suggesting they run for public office?
What are some things that that normal people can do who care about this issue, who'd like to see Illinois actually get more progressive?
Well, you know, first of all, there are a number of things they can do, and this is even a very propitious time to do it. Like I said, Governor Quinn is very brave to tell us all right now in Illinois what we need to hear, not what we want to hear. And there have been a number of legislators that have put in bills, House Bill 855, Senate Bill 750, that would solve our long-term fiscal problems, would make the state's tax system more progressive, incorporate things like the refundable credit I talked about, the family tax credit, while making the tax changes we'd need, and would even do a better job of funding our schools. So right now, with a governor who clearly wouldn't veto something like that, who would work with the legislature to pass that, we have some great legislation and a real opportunity.
So House Bill 750, that's for educational tax reform, as I recall.
Yeah, well, it's now Senate Bill 750. It's House Bill 855.
Okay.
They're the same bill, but a little different number in the House.
Okay.
And it's a real opportunity, but the opportunity could be lost unless, and here's where your listeners come in, unless listeners really come out there and go visit their legislators, their representatives, their senators in district. It's great to go to Springfield on lobby days and all that, and I support that. It has an impact. But a much bigger impact occurs when voters, constituents, show up at a legislator's office in district with three or four or five or six or seven of their friends and say, we need you to do this. Because very much elected officials believe in the cockroach theory of voters. And I don't know if you know this one, but the cockroach theory of voters is a pretty simple one. For every one or two or three that show up in my office, there's another 100 scurrying about the walls with the same view. And it's a really powerful thing to not only just show up once, because if you're talking about a pretty controversial, pretty difficult piece of legislation like tax reform, school funding reform bill, you're probably going to hear no, right, in most legislators' offices.
Well, they may not say it, but they'll dismiss you.
Yeah. But if you come back more than one time and with different faces.
Or if you get your friends.
Yeah. Different faces, you and some of your friends, and different friends every time, and you approach that legislator in their office three or four or five times, they're going to change their mind. They're going to be a lot more willing to get involved and lead. And this is a great time to do that. And I think, is Mike Frerichs the state senator?
Yes, he is.
He's been very open about supporting this kind of approach to tax reform and school funding reform. I think he ran on House Bill, Senate Bill 750 when he first got elected a few years back, just a couple years back. And he's clearly been one of the more bold and progressive voices in the legislature already.
And locally here, Naomi Jacobson's our other state rep, and I believe she's been supportive of these, although I can't promise you that.
Yeah, I don't recall where Naomi's coming on, okay, onto this, and so maybe she's one that a visit would be a good thing.
And when you get a yes from a legislator, from a senator, what's the next step?
Well, the next step is to follow up. I think a letter-writing campaign or motivating people in your community, maybe hosting, a little coffee at your house or a town hall forum where people could have an open discussion on this and they could get their questions answered. You know, Steve, those are very valuable things. I mean, you've heard sort of the longer presentation, but really even in a 15 or 20-minute shot, when voters feel like they're getting their questions answered, they quickly come to understand just sort of how egregious and how poor designed the Illinois system is right now, and most people are fair-minded. Whether they are liberal or conservative in their ideological view of the world, I think most people truly are fair, and when they get good information in, they are willing to take action and move on. And so certainly getting people in the community to understand and support it and back it would be the next step. And I think from a purely political standpoint, letters to Governor Quinn, congratulating him for being brave, but saying, Governor, go and do what needs to be done. Find a way to make Senate Bill 750, House Bill 855 law. That's very powerful. Senate President John Cullerton needs to hear from people. He's a very influential guy. And the good news about Senate President Cullerton is he's not Emil Jones. Cullerton is a policy guy. He gets it. And certainly if he hears a lot of encouragement, I think he would really lead in the Illinois Senate. Certainly House Speaker Madigan needs to hear. The two minority leaders, Tom Cross, the Republican leader in the House, and Christine Redonio, the Republican leader in the Senate, need to hear. I mean, so once you've sort of secured your own legislator, then help with the bigger move by a letter-writing campaign to some of what's called the four tops. And really get them involved, let them hear how you feel, let them hear that you support these important initiatives, let them hear that you understand it. You don't have to write it like a policy wonk. You could write it like, in fact, it's more powerful if you write it in your typical, look, I don't understand everything about these bills, but I understand that they're a tax increase, I understand they're going to make things fairer, I understand they're going to let us fund our schools, and I want you to do that.
Ralph, we're going to have to stop there. We're out of time. Really appreciate you being on the program. We've been talking with Ralph Martire, the Executive Director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, deal with things here, mainly in Illinois, but also in Indiana and other places, I understand now. If you'd like to learn more about ctbaonline.org is the place to go via your computer. Let me remind folks that University Y will not be having programs this week because of spring break, but we'll be starting up here locally March 31st with Know Your University, the Edible Book Festival, and April 3rd, Professor Bruce Folk talking about microbial life. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Keepin' the Faith is made possible in part by the Quaker Meeting of Champaign-Urbana, a local community dedicated to the Quakers' testimony of peace, equality, integrity, and simplicity. The weekly meeting includes silent worship Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. at 1904 East Main Street in Urbana. Online at quaker.org/urbana.
Imagine a poor child in Uruguay. Now imagine giving that young girl a $100 laptop computer and the educational opportunities that this laptop will provide. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, under the best of our knowledge, Nicholas Negroponte has this very vision, and he's making it a reality throughout the developing world. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
This evening at 7. AM 580 has a listener comment line. If you'd like to comment on something you hear on the Information Advantage, call 217-333-0853 and leave a message. That's 217-333-0853.
This is WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and